Can I ask you to turn back to your Bible, Psalm 24, or pull it back up on your phone or tablet, and keep the words in front of you, because we will spend a moment reflecting on the words of the psalm itself. But I know that some of you really like your rock music, and you've purchased many different albums and singles and so on in the past, but I doubt that many of you ever bought a record by the Australian artist and TV presenter called Rolf Harris. Anyone bought a Rolf Harris song? I didn't think so. But Rolf Harris, some years ago, sang a song which sounded like a bit of a pleasant but silly little song about two little boys who had two little toys. Each had a wooden horse. Gaily they played each summer's day, warriors both, of course. And it goes on, and it makes you smile as you imagine these two little boys charging around with their sticks, playing at horses in the backyard, blue sky and puffy white clouds up above them. But what's astonishing about that silly little pleasant song is it actually was number one in the hits charts for something like 7 weeks. Quite astonishing for the kind of song that it is. But what I think made it a number one hit for 7 weeks was not so much the pleasant little ditty that it was, but actually the setting out of which the song came. Because what Rolf Harris had done was he'd borrowed words from an old song that was probably written for the American Civil War, and these old words that he had borrowed, he then sang, but he sang them in 1969. And he sang them in 1969 when there was something like 500,000 American soldiers still in Vietnam. And there's a very good likelihood that the silly little pleasant song was actually an anti-war protest song that really caught the imagination of those who listened to it at that time because of the setting in which he sang it. And so the setting and the context out of which songs come are invariably so important. And so as we've been looking at the Psalms, we've been talking about that because Psalms are songs. Invariably, they're songs. In fact, in Psalm 22, right above the first line, it actually has a wee note to the musical director. Psalm 24 that we're looking at today, if you actually look at the end of verse 6, it's got a funny wee word tucked to the right of your Bible, the word Selah. And at the end of the psalm, it's got another word, Selah, again. And these are probably some musical notes that should somehow or other help those who are musicians singing, playing the song. Psalm 24, when you read it, doesn't say much about the background in the same way that two little boys with two little toys doesn't say immediately about the background. But Psalm 24, I think it does have a context which helps us understand the psalm. And I want us to look at that context, and maybe for some of us it's a context in our Bible that we've never heard before. We're maybe going to learn something of the story of God's people that we've never dipped into before today, because for some of us we'll be in kind of strange Old Testament territory. But the Psalms, with that kind of context, are a bit like hill walking in Scotland. Some of you like to climb Munros, some of you have chalked off, if not all the Munros, then nearly all of them. And the Psalms are a wee bit like walking hills in Scotland. You know, you've been walking and walking and walking, and finally exhausted because of the dampness and the cloud with which you have to walk, suddenly you see the peak and you head up to it. And in the context of the Psalms, that's like what the Psalms tells you about the context, or you work out what the context is. There it is right in front of you. And you get up, and you're so excited. And then, like these Scottish hills, you get there, and there's another peak further ahead. This wasn't really the peak. And so then off you go, and it's so far ahead, you can hardly see it through the mist and the clouds and the rain, which invariably is what it's like when you're climbing Munros in Scotland. And so when you read the Psalms, you see this peak, the context out of which they come. But then when you see that peak, you suddenly realize, actually, there's a further one. And the further peak is invariably actually the coming of the Lord Jesus and the work of the Lord Jesus. So Psalm 22, we saw that David had the agony of an experience that he wrote about in Psalm 22. There was this peak, there's the context out of which he wrote. But then when you got into the psalm, you realize, no, there's another peak further ahead. And of course, Jesus went through the experience of the cross that was being detailed in Psalm 22. And in fact, not only that, but made it known by saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Using the words of the Psalm. And he made us think, why was Jesus forsaken? Why was he forsaken? And then Psalm 23, you realize here's the shepherd, and you realize David, who wrote the psalm, was a shepherd. There's the peak. David's a shepherd. He's realizing that God is like a shepherd to him. And then as he begins to talk about the care and the intimacy of the shepherd's love and looking after him, that he takes you to a place where he says, and I'll dwell in the house forever and you with the Lord forever. And you're thinking, that's quite an interesting thing to say when you're just thinking about shepherd and sheep. And of course, Jesus then later on says, I'm the good shepherd. There's the further peak with Jesus. To the degree that Jesus says, in order to be the good shepherd, I'll lay down my life for the sheep. In order for Jesus to be the good shepherd of Psalm 23, he has to go through the cross of Psalm 22. And then you get to Psalm 24, and you're thinking, well, what's going on here? And all it helps us with at the top is of David. Psalm 24, just above the first line. Of David. A psalm, and not much detail is given. I'm going to suggest to you today that there's a context, there's a peak that we're going to see, but then when we see that peak, beyond that, we're looking not just to that peak of experience of David and what's going on then, but actually of Jesus himself. And that the psalm is therefore not just the psalm of David, but actually the psalm of the crown which Jesus himself came to wear. But in terms of that first peak that we're making our way up to, I want to suggest there's probably about three little hooks, at least three little hooks, that show us from another place what David is thinking when he's writing this psalm, okay? And I'm taking you into territory, I think, that could be unfamiliar to you. But if you look at verse 3, David hits this striking question. Verse 3 says, who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? Now, sometime before, David, king of Israel, sometime before, God had called this people into a relationship with himself. He had taken them towards a land called the Promised Land, and he gave them 10 commandments, which summarized how they were to live in relationship with God, covenant relationship with God in the land, and covenant relationship with one another. The 10 commandments. We all heard of the 10 commandments. And these 10 commandments, once given, were then put in and kept in a box. And that box had a strange name given to it. The strange name given to the box into which the 10 commandments were put was called the Ark of the Covenant. Because the way that the covenant with God was to be worked out was summarized in these 10 commandments. And so instead of calling it the box of the covenant, they called it the Ark of the Covenant. And so in the Old Testament, you find different places where the Ark of the Covenant is spoken about. But, you know, there's something about human beings, something about us and our relationship with God, where we begin to think that somehow or other we can control God and manipulate God, and we make God a wee bit of a talisman, or somehow or other we make him kind of domesticated. And when we say things like he's our God, actually what we mean is we've got some kind of control over him. And we try to manipulate him. We try to make our will his will instead of his will our will. Well, the people of God who had been brought into this worshiping relationship with the Lord Almighty forever were trying to make God this kind of puppet God that they could control. And especially when they saw that the presence of God was so closely connected to the covenant and the covenant stipulations of the Ten Commandments. And so what they began to do was take the Ark of the Covenant, the box in which the Ten Commandments were, and they started to take it around with them, thinking that if we can kind of wheel around the box or carry around the box with the Ten Commandments, it means we've got God with us, and whatever we want to do, that will succeed. And so back in 1 Samuel, in chapter 4 through 6, there's a particular time when that's exactly what they did. And they took the ark, and they went out into a battle that they wanted to fight. They thought, for sure, we're going to win this battle because we've got God on our side, because we've got him in our box, as it were. And they got beaten. And not only that, the Philistines took the Ark of the Covenant from them. And when word got back in 1 Samuel chapter 4, 22, verse 22, that not only had they been beaten, but that the Ark of the Covenant had been taken, somebody says this. They said, "The glory has departed from Israel." The glory has departed from Israel. Well, if you look at the end of Psalm 24, you see the reverse of this happening. Lift up your head, you ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who's the King of Glory? Lift up your heads, O you gates, that the King of Glory may come in. Who's the King of Glory? The Lord Almighty, verse 10, he's the King of Glory. The glory back in 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 22 had departed. But here in the psalm, the glory of the Lord is returning in whatever's happening here in Psalm 24. So I think that's one of the big connections, this connection with the glory. The second connection, I think, with that story back in 1 Samuel chapter 4 through 6 is that when the Philistines think they've captured their Israelites' God, and the Israelites had thought that they could manipulate events by having God in a box with them. Well, the Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant and they put the Ark into the temple of their little idol Dagon. And God's not going to have that. And so when there's nobody around, basically Dagon collapses in a heap. He smashes up and the Philistines are shocked. And not only that, but when the Philistines think they've got control of this God of the Israelites, God inflicts or afflicts them with different ailments. To the degree they say, get rid of this ark, we want this out of Philistia, and so they send the ark back up to Israel. But God is not manipulated either or controlled by Philistines or Israelites. And so when the ark gets back into Israel, every time the people of God, the Israelites, disrespect it, the Ark of the Covenant, they too were struck down. There's no controlling God. There's no having God like your little puppet God, not whether you're in Israel at that time or whether you're in Philistia. And so at some point when in 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 20, the Ark is back in Israel and judgment's falling on anyone who has disrespected that Ark and the presence of God that's so symbolized and associated with the Ark, they say this, 1 Samuel chapter 6, verse 20, "Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? Who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God?" And if you look at verse 3, that's very similar. David thinking the same question, "Who may stand in this holy place? Who may ascend the hill of the Lord?" I think David's remembering the events of when the ark was taken and when it was returned into Israel. And that question with the afflictions that were falling upon all who would treat the ark so disrespectfully, who could stand in this presence of this holy Lord? And then the third and final clue, which I think gives us an understanding of what's happening, is that it's David himself who then brings the ark back into Jerusalem. You know, some of you have worked in London, and you know that whether you're coming from Cornwall or whether you're coming from Birmingham, you always go up to London because London just deems itself so special. You know, you go up to London. Well, it's a different thing when you go up to Jerusalem, because when you go to Jerusalem, it's not only because, like London, it's the kind of capital city, important city, so everybody goes up to London, up to Jerusalem. No, you literally do, because Jerusalem's on a hill. And so wherever you're coming from, you go up to Jerusalem. And so when David, the psalmist, says in verse 3, "Who may ascend the hill of the Lord?" He's talking about the Lord in that place of worship on top of the hill in Jerusalem. And David is the one who's bringing the ark back to that city of David so that God himself and his presence and the stipulations of the covenant might be right there in the heart and in the midst of his people. And so David brings back the ark to Jerusalem. And so when he says in chapter 24 and verse 7, "Lift up your head, your gates be lifted up," he's like personalizing the gates and the doors of Jerusalem. And he's saying, lift up your heads and let the Lord Almighty come back in, this King of Glory come back in, as he brings back the ark up into Jerusalem. And so when he asks, "Who may ascend the hill of the Lord?" He's saying, who could go up into this great, glorious king's place? And he knows that even he can't. In fact, as he's taking the ark back, he doesn't move just about without worshiping and sacrificing for sin and guilt offerings before the Lord, because he knows that even he is not one, as it says here in verse 4, who has clean hands and a pure heart. Even David, King David, who wants to bring the ark back, even he knows that he's not the one who's so pure. And so I think the context is the taking of the ark so associated with the presence and the glory of God, so that when it was taken, they said, the glory has departed from Israel. And now David bringing the ark back into Jerusalem through the gates, through the doors, that place of worship, and them saying, the King of Glory, he's the one who's come back. That's the context, I think, in which this is happening. And David is putting these words together to accompany this procession. And when you begin the psalm, if you look at the words that begin the psalm, and it starts off by saying, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. I think what he's saying here is, do not think for one second that this God about whom we are speaking, is some kind of little puppet God that you can manipulate, that you can somehow or other control, that he's going to do your will as opposed to you doing his will. Not so, because let me tell you, David says, this Lord, the earth is his, everything in it. And if you're a Philistine or if you're an Israelite, then you also, all who live in this world, you are his. If you turned us all upside down, looked at our feet, turned over a rock, looked at the dirty bit, managed to somehow or other excavate a mountain, turn it upside down, on every single thing would be printed the word mine. Belongs to the Lord. Belongs to the Lord. And David is, I think, not only saying things that are true, but he's saying to the Israelites of that time, you know this, don't you? You remember this, don't you? Because we have got this so wrong in the past. But you remember this now, as we bring back the ark and the glory of the Lord into our place of worship. And so when David comes to these great words of verse 7 through 10, and he's talking about the King of Glory coming in, and there's a kind of call and response going on. I don't think that call and response is simply for musical interest. You know, lift up your head, you gates, be lifted up, you ancient of days, the doors that the King of Glory may come in. And then it shouts back, who is the King of Glory? And then the response comes again, the Lord is strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. I don't think it's just for musical interest. David does this kind of call response type thing. I think what he's doing is he's actually engaging those who are bringing the ark back in and saying, do you remember? Do you know who it is so associated with this ark? So lift your heads up that the King of Glory may come in. And the question then is, well, who is the King of Glory? Ask that question. Who is the King of Glory? Well, let me tell you, David says, do you remember this? The Lord strong and mighty. The Lord mighty in battle. And then he repeats it again just to make sure the point is really made. Lift up your head. Lift them up, you ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. So ask the question, who is the King of Glory? Let me tell you the answer. Not Dagon, not Baal, not Asherah, not some 21st century philosophy of life, not some other religious iconic person who's held up. Let me tell you who the King of Glory is. He's the Lord Almighty. He is the King of Glory. And so David brings back the ark, and he wants no mistake about who they worship. He wants no mistake about who they belong to. Lift your heads up, you gates. Let them in. Let them in. 1 Samuel 4, the glory had departed. Psalm 24, oh, the king is back. The king is back. And a reaffirmation of this understanding of who Yahweh, the Lord, is to his people. And David, one of the words that's repeated here, David, so aware of the greatness of God, uses repeatedly this word glory, 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 the King of glory, the King of glory. Who is this King of glory? And the word glory in Hebrew is a word called kavod. And what basically the kind of idea behind it is, it's just a huge weightiness. A huge weightiness and a heaviness and a solidity and a majesty, that the kavod, the glory, is actually God's alone, because there's nothing about humanity, nothing about the world that could ever in any way measure or even attain in any way to the glory, to the weightiness, to the majestic being of the Lord Almighty. And so David uses this word glory repeatedly here. He's not just the king, he's the king of majesty. He's the king of everything. He is the heaviest, weightiest, most respected, most revered king of kings. And so when David is just so full of the reality of God, he asks this question again, not just now remembering what was asked before in 1 Samuel, but asking it now because this is real. We're bringing back the ark into Israel. This is real. Who, verse 3, can ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? That's a question, actually, that we should all ask. David became so aware of the greatness and the glory and the holiness of God, that he asked this question, not just repeating it because it was asked before, but genuinely asking it, who can stand in the presence of God? And David, because of the way when you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 6, which is where he comes with the ark back into to Jerusalem, there you realize David knows, I can't even stand in the presence of God, because he doesn't move, as I said, before he sacrifices animals for his sin and for guilt offerings, because he realizes that he does not have, verse 4, clean hands and a pure heart. And so we're at this peak with David, and we see why the psalm was written, because the king is back, the crown, as it were, is back within Israel. But we're left questioning with David. And as David asks the question, we start to see that there's this distant peak again, way in the distance, pointing to another summit, a greater summit, a higher summit that we have to realize and ascend to. The Philistines thought they could swan into God's presence with their hands in their pockets, chewing gum. Well, we sometimes think that we can swan into God's presence with our hands in our pockets, chewing gum. But we sometimes think that, you know, he's our buddy, our pal, our boyfriend, our mate. He's the King of glory. And when we look ahead to that other place, that next summit, what we begin to see is a character, a figure, a different type of king, not now David, but a son of David. An ordinary-looking person to begin with. And of course, we're talking about Jesus. And we begin to see Jesus now as the one who comes, not looking very glorious, looking very ordinary, like the rest of people. Nothing about his appearance that would drag you in or appeal to you. Except that, here's the one who has clean hands. He doesn't do anything that's contrary to the will of God. Here's the one who has a pure heart. His actions are all motivated by the sinlessness and the purity of his spirit. Here's the one who, verse 4 in Psalm 24, never lifted his soul to an idol. When he was tempted to worship others or Satan, he would not give in. He would not lift his soul to an idol. He wouldn't swear by anything false. All he said was true and the truth. In one place, he confirmed this by saying, I am the truth. We begin to see Jesus. But the problem is, we begin to see Jesus who then is ignored by many people. We begin to see Jesus who is abused by many people. We begin to see Jesus who's then put on a cross by many people. And it almost looks as if there's no glory in any of this. But of course, as the psalm says, the one who is of clean hands and pure heart, he'll receive the blessing of God. He will get the vindication of the Lord. And so on the third day, we see Jesus raised from the dead, vindicated as to the truthfulness of what he said, the accuracy of what he was doing in the bringing of forgiveness of sin. But don't stop there. What do we see? What we see then is about 40 days later, this same Jesus now brought and glorified back into the presence of God from which he came, into the majesty and the royal throne room of God, the very glory that is God, that we know to be God, the Lord Almighty, that the psalmist speaks of. Now here's Jesus back in the presence of God, ascended, sitting at the right hand of the Father. Majestic, vindicated, blessed, confirmed, enthroned, the King of Kings, the King of Glory. Here's Jesus now, back in that great heavenly place. It's like David is looking at that faraway summit where he's talking about the very gates and doors of heaven. You ancient gates, you doors, lift up your heads and let the King of Glory come back in. And Jesus is that King of Glory, that ascended Jesus. Well, let me just finish off by asking this question. So you read Psalm 24 and you then see the summits of David and the ark, and you catch a glimpse of Jesus coming into his glory in heaven with God the Father, having secured salvation for those who believe in him. You see a glimpse of that and you say, what does it mean to me? Well, I'm embarrassed to say that I preached on this Psalm many, many, many years ago, and I managed to keep it on file, and I glanced back, and in my aim, I think, at trying to make a solid application to those of us who were listening, I'm a wee bit embarrassed to say that the first thing I said was, well, we need to open, you know, our hearts have to have gates opened up and doors need to be opened up when we need to receive the King of Glory in. But I think that that's not the first thing that we need to be doing. I think the first thing that we need to be doing is actually maybe being silenced and just falling down in awe that we could somehow or other glimpse the glory and the majesty of Jesus Christ. And if we can gather ourselves, the first things we need to be doing then is literally giving ourselves in humble worship, humble submission to the one who's the King of Kings. The one who went through the cross of Psalm 22, the one who's so close and intimate to his people like a shepherd in Psalm 23, now is the one who is glorified. And I think we need to bow in adoration and praise of Jesus. We come into his presence and we want to pray and we say, oh Lord Jesus, but what are we going to follow that with? And what's the mood with which we come into his presence? You're my pal, you're my buddy. I think not. I think we say, you're the King of Kings, you're the Lord of Lords. And you're glorious. And I want to worship you. And I praise you that by your grace you allow me into your presence. I have no right to be here. No right whatsoever. I haven't got clean hands. I don't have a pure heart. I have lifted my soul to an idol. I have told untruths. I have no right to be here, and yet by your grace and through your own work for me, you allow me into your presence. I am humbled in worship. I think the second thing it brings to us is then we have what a confidence. Because when we trust a king like this and we know that he has given us the right to be with him through this faith that he draws us into, then we have such a confidence. Why do we have such confidence? Because this is not just some old character that we've kind of imported nice things to. He kind of lived 2,000 years ago. This is God the Son. This is the one who has entered glory on behalf not only of his own name, that he might do that which he said he would do, but for us. Therefore, that which he said he would do for us, take us to the place that he is, all who are trusting in him, I can have complete confidence because he's the, in the words of Psalm 24, in the words of verse 8, he's the Lord strong and mighty. He's going to make it happen. He's the one who's mighty in battle. He has defeated Satan. He's defeated sin. He's defeated death. He's brought life eternal, and he's done that for us. Oh, the confidence that I can have in Jesus is astounding. And somebody, as was once said to me, might say to you, well, that's very arrogant, Scott. It's very arrogant to say that you can be confident of standing in the presence of God. And I want to scream and say, it's got nothing to do with arrogance. It's got nothing to do with me. It's got, all I bring is my sin and my guilt and my failings. My confidence is in Jesus Christ because he's the King of Glory. Maybe it's only when we are disabused of our own self and we realize that our confidence is completely based on him, that actually the what we do here on a Sunday morning, what you do in your own devotion, suddenly becomes alive because we are being drawn into the presence of the King of Kings in whom we can have full confidence. And just thirdly, let me say this, it calls us to an allegiance. It calls us to an allegiance. Is there anybody here today who has not given themselves in allegiance to this King? He is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He's mighty in battle, and he amazingly, by his grace, invites you to be part of his kingdom. Today is the day, if you've never done it, today is the day, settle with the Lord. Ask that you might be one of his people, one of his subjects, that he might be your Lord, that he might rule your life, that he might be your King. That you might, by his grace, come into his presence, even though you recognize that your hands are not clean, your heart is not pure. That you ask his forgiveness, and that you take the grace that he holds out as a gift to you. If this is the day for you, then make it your day. But those of us who have already begun to follow this King, what a day to hear the psalm and to be reminded of the allegiance we have to this great King, and to be encouraged in it and by the fact that he is this Lord, and he's this Lord for us. Absolutely amazing. I want to give him myself. I want to give him my life. Do you want to? Do you want to? He's willing. He's willing. I said these years ago, open your hearts, let the gates of your hearts be opened up. But the amazing thing is actually he allows us through his gates, his doors. He said, I am the door. I'm the gate. He allows us through the barriers that he might put up by his mercy. Let him be our King. Let's be in full allegiance with him. And you know, as the psalm starts, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Let's not be arrogant in any way. You know, we say we're the church and we are the church, but you know, the church is called from all parts and every part and every people group. I mean, that's the whole point, is that God is actually Lord of all. He's made everything. And from every place and every people group, he will call people to himself. So we are so privileged to be a part of that. But let's not be in any way arrogant about that, because God is in the business of calling by his mercy through Jesus people from every background and place that we could hardly imagine. And we would probably dare not to think, but he is. Because that sin-defeating work of Christ is sin-defeating work for us and for others wonderfully as well. We bow in his glory and worship, we have a new confidence and we have a great renewed allegiance, don't we? Because he's our King.